In late July, the eyes of the world will focus on Paris as the 33rd Olympiad begins. The best athletes in the world will come together in the spirit of competition, of goodwill, and in the pursuit of excellence as they represent one of 206 countries in the Summer Games. The American Psychological Association defines sports psychology as proficiency that uses psychological knowledge and skill to address optimal performance and well-being of athletes, developmental and social aspects of sports participation, and systemic issues associated with sports settings and organizations. In order to address the concerns of athletes seeking peak performance in their sport, sets of skills and procedures are used, including cognitive and behavioral skills training for performance enhancement, counseling and clinical interventions, and consultation and training. These go hand in hand with the rigorous physical training required to compete at the highest levels. Although my only connection to the Olympics is being beaten on the track soundly and regularly at the collegiate level by Brian Crossman of Fitchburg State, who represented Ireland in track and field at international competition, our two guests today actually have lived experience on Olympic teams. Margot Farrell is a dual citizen who was completed for the French national swim team as a finalist at the World University Games, a silver medalist in the 4x200 meter freestyle relay at the European Championships, and a bronze medalist in that same relay at the 2012 London Olympic Games. She was a Division I athlete and swam at Indiana University, where she was a multiple-time All-American and two-year captain. She also swam professionally while getting her master's degree from the University of Southern California. Following her swimming career, she was a journalist and most recently a news anchor at Fox 61 in Hartford, Connecticut. She has since transitioned to working at the Root Center for Advanced Recovery, a mental health and addiction nonprofit in Connecticut, where she is their new chief of staff. She is also a swimming analyst for the Big Ten Network. Dr. Shane Murphy was the first full-time sports psychologist for the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee and was the sports psychologist for Team USA at the 1988-1992 Olympics. He was also the sports psychologist for several individual sports for the Olympic Games of 1996 and 2000. Dr. Murphy is a professor of psychology at Western Connecticut State University, where he teaches clinical, sport, and health psychology, and is the graduate coordinator of the MS and Addiction Studies. Shane's books include the Oxford Handbook of Sport and Performance Psychology, Sport Psychology Interventions, the Sport Psych Handbook, the Achievement Zone, and the Cheers and the Tears. His research focuses on the use of imagery in sport, burnout in gamers, and the assessment of psychological performance skills. Dr. Murphy received his PhD in clinical psychology from Rutgers University, specializing in cognitive behavioral therapy. We welcome you both to the podcast. Glad to see you both.
Thank you for having us.
Now, for people that listen to us normally, they'll see that this is a little outside the scope of what we normally do. But I think with the Olympics coming and some of the things we'll talk about today, we'll see a connection. And actually, by the time we finish, we'll kind of tie it all together to what we normally do. So here's my first question. When we talk about sports psychology, what exactly do we mean?
Well, I'd be interested to hear from Margot, from an athlete's perspective, how do you perceive sports psychology?
Well, I think that my idea of sports psychology has shifted from when I was an athlete to now. So I competed in the 2012 Olympic Games. So we're going back a couple of games now. And I feel like mental health back in the era of college for me was 2008 to 2012 was really not at the forefront as it is right now. I was introduced to a sports psychologist in my time there when I first was ever diagnosed with anxiety, ever started experiencing emotions of anxiety and depression. That was kind of an abnormal thing, if you will. It was not something that many people on the team were doing. It was not something that many of my counterparts I knew were doing. As the years went on, it started to be that more and more of us were seeing a therapist. I ended up going more from a sports psychologist to a therapist because my issues weren't necessarily always rooted in athletics. I think that exacerbated some of the things I was dealing with, but I had tried both a sports psychologist and a traditional therapist. And I look back now and I remember just feeling really embarrassed, really ashamed to say that. And now, you know, I'll sing it from the rooftops that I see a therapist. I work at a mental health organization. I have no shame around it. And I feel like most people that I know either are in therapy or have been at some point, athlete or not. So I think sports psychology, what I'd like to think of it as now, is both a combination of your regular, quote unquote, non-athletic life and your athletic life coming together, because there's no such thing, I think, as just your athlete life. Your athlete life is a bunch of other things. I used to always say, I am an athlete. Athletics is a part of my life. It is not my life. So it was just one chapter of the book for me. So I think it's kind of twofold. It's depending on the person. Some people may just really have performance-based issues that they want to address. And for that, I think it's one component. And then other people may have mental health issues that intertwine or get exacerbated through their athletics. So it's a little different. And I think my appreciation for it is definitely different now that I'm removed from it than when I was there. I didn't have as much of an understanding. And I also thought it was, you know, something to kind of hide about a little bit, something I didn't necessarily want everybody to know. I had a little bit of embarrassment around it. So it's a little difficult to say because even my own understanding of it has changed in the last decade or so.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing that very much mirrors my experience as a sports psychologist. Example, I worked first for the U.S. Olympic Committee in 1986. So that's nearly 40 years ago now, Jeff. It's changed so much over those years. That was the same year that the Association for Applied Sports Psychology was founded and the division of the American Psychological Association, APA, Sport, Exercise, and Performance Psychology was founded. So I was very lucky to sort of be in on the ground floor. And that the biggest change I've seen is what Margo was talking about, is that athletes were very reluctant to sort of be identified as seeing a psychologist back in the 80s and 90s. And today, it's very much a thing that people will talk about, be very open about. You know, we've seen some really interesting examples, like athletes even like at the Olympics, you know, pulling out of events for their own mental health, some own bios, and like really well-known athletes, which I think sets the tone for everybody else to say, oh, it's okay to talk about. And as Margo said, I've always preached the same thing, that sports psychology is about seeing the athlete as an entire person. You just can't break anyone's life into just say, oh, this is your sport and your performance. Let's just focus on that. And we'll just forget about everything else that's happening in your life because it has no impact on you. That's not how we work as human beings.
And that's kind of a perfect lead into where I want to go next. And also with goes with something that Margo said, that you were an athlete, but that was just a small part of your life. Fans and spectators often see these athletes at the highest levels as machines. Older generations drawing on the stereotype of Soviet and East German teams of the past, where we really had a belief that they lived that and probably did live that life. But we're seeing a change in that perspective. Can you think of a specific occurrence or event that kind of got us to change the way we look at that, that athletes are people too?
I have a tough one with this just because I think while it's headed in that direction, it's definitely still not there. You mentioned kind of the Soviets and the East Germans. So ironically, my mother, she was an athlete as well. She missed the 1976 games by 1/100 of a second. And she competed against the East Germans and the Soviets at that time. So she, you know, used to always tell me about what it was like then. You know, they didn't have an option. Steroids was just like a given. And it's like, take this and you don't even ask questions. And I was just talking about this with someone the other day, that in terms of mental health and just how we view athletics, it's definitely gotten better. Like things that flew when my mom was swimming don't fly when I was swimming. Then things that were flying when I was swimming, I definitely don't see that flying anymore. Like I think we're slowly starting to see things that are no longer acceptable. I think most notably in the last year, I think it was Tori McKeever, the head coach at the Cal swimming team for the women's team. And she'd been there forever. I mean, storied coach, won many national titles, many national champions under her. She got fired and she got into a lot of trouble because girls came forward and they were saying that they had suicidal ideation. They had eating disorders that were developed. And in a somewhat joking fashion, some of my girlfriends and I were saying, well, you know, some of our coaches better hope that we don't open our mouths. And it's not to say like, I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole or say those things. There were comments, you know, that I can specifically remember, things that I did, things that I said that would not fly today with cancel culture and all that kind of stuff. But I still don't think we're there yet. Places like the NCAA, they say they're put in place to really protect the athlete and to make sure it's a student athlete. And it's, don't get me started on that soapbox. I'll be the first to admit it, that we were training well over the 20-hour cap. And most teams today are still training over the 20-hour cap. Because if I'm being honest, especially in a sport like swimming, you probably do need more than that amount of training to stay at a certain peak level. So I don't know how it is that we start to improve that. It's definitely not like it was with the East Germans and the Soviets back in the day. But if I'm being honest, I think that athletics is, it's still not at that perfect spot. And that's why you see people come out like Simone Biles and even Michael Phelps, who, you know, has had his fair share of mental health struggles that he's been very vocal about. There's a Naomi Osaka. I could list a million of them where it just shows it's like we might be better and that we're more accepting of it. But I think the rigors of training and things like that, that's still pretty consistent. It's been consistently the same.
Mm-hmm. Shane, anything to add?
One of the things I've noticed in my field, in my profession, is that we have moved in sports psychology to be much more comfortable with advocacy. That was not something that we were expected to do or asked to do. It was almost like if you were a part of the sports culture, you know, you were just part of the team. You know, I think some of the issues that have happened, like sexual abuse scandal, you know, with the gymnastics teams, the fact that, you know, athletes have come forward, as Margot was saying, and much more open about their pasts. I think it's been a real positive to shining a light on how we can balance sports and the rest of life better. But I think one area where we still have a long way to go is just the fans' appreciation. You know, I think fans feel like, you know, especially in professional sports, they buy the ticket, they can abuse the athletes from the stands, yell whatever they want. I bought the ticket, it's my money. And they still do not see athletes as people. You know, you read the comments in social media, somebody strikes out in the bottom of the ninth with the bases loaded. And it's just still appalling the way people look at athletes. So as Margot said, we still have quite a ways to go there.
I think it was Michael Phelps that opened up that, hey, he's normalizing and he's making every effort. But then, of course, they negatively attacked him for his marijuana use and things. But he was the first one to really open his mouth and say something that I struggle with this and it's just part of my life.
I was just going to hop off. So I was working in news when the Simone Biles thing came out where she withdrew. And I actually did this whole Facebook Live because I was fired up when I was seeing the reaction of people coming after her and comments that were made like you took a spot from somebody else. Well, no, that's why we have alternates. It's because if she had broken her leg, nobody would have had to say anything if they would have put the alternate in her place, who now had a chance and did very well. And people just, you don't know what it's like. And it's so easy to be sitting on your couch or to be a Monday morning quarterback and all those things. And that year, especially, like it was the COVID Olympics. A lot of people don't realize that there were no fans. There was no family. Like everything you worked for, everything that was the tradition of the Olympics was so different. No one was talking about she had a death in the family. I believe it was her aunt. There was all these different things. But yeah, Shane, you mentioned the comments. That's where you can see we have a lot of work to be done. While it is definitely great and like people are, there's that whole side that is more understanding. It was the same comment with athletes. Like if I ever complained, it's like, well, you're on a scholarship. What are you complaining about? And it was like, well, this was well before the days of the NIL and things like that. When you break down the amount of hours that I was swimming and the things that I did for the university, it was like less than minimum wage if you really wanted to break it down on a scholarship number.
I still think there's a real lack of appreciation for just the psychology of high performance. What a fine line most athletes tread, especially in a sport like gymnastics, where if you're not there 100%, it is dangerous. You know, you can break your neck. A lot of sports that I've worked with, skiing and so on, that's still the same. And I think another one, Jeff, that I think really caught public attention was when Hamlin dropped nearly dead of a heart attack in a Monday night football game for the Buffalo Bills. And to see, like, one of the comments afterwards was, why did they call the game off? They should have just gone ahead and played. But what people don't realize is like the other athletes are incredibly affected by that. It's really hard to get your head back in the game, quote unquote, when you've just seen your friend, your comrade, your brother nearly die right in front of your eyes. There's no easy way to come back from that.
Soon after that happened, one of the podcasts, we talked about the mental health of players with the team psychologist for the LA Rams. And one of the things that she said was, if you're a player in the league, whether you know him or not, there's a brotherhood. It's a very small club that you're in. So you do worry about that next person. Hurting someone in the course of a game may be okay, but seeing someone get injured is not okay. It's a fine line and it's strange. But when you're at a certain level, your competitors, there's a brotherhood or sisterhood because you've all reached a certain level and others haven't. So there's different understanding. So I thought that was interesting when she talked about it. One thing that most of us listening will never quite grasp is the pressure cooker that the highest level of competition, certainly the Olympic Games, what they are. Larry Bird, Magic Johnson back with the Dream Team, and Charles Barkley, they all said that there was something different about competing in the Olympics, representing your country, representing as opposed to getting paid to be a professional. So can you talk a little bit about that pressure that people feel, that the athletes and all the other team members feel? Because it's not just those who are competing, but the people that help them get ready and everyone associated with the team.
Yeah, well, and I had an interesting experience going into the games. I had a torn labrum at the time. I didn't know that's what it was. I had a lot of pain in my back. And as it turned out, my hip labrum was completely torn open. And leading up to the games, I didn't want to say anything because I was on a relay. And that relay did have a chance at making a medal. So the psychology that I was dealing with was that, okay, if I screw up, this is not just on me. This is on the whole country. It is not just like my individual race that I tank. I could potentially impact us bringing home a medal or not. So that was a lot that I was dealing with mentally of how much do I say, how much do I not say, because I needed to get worked on and I was having all these tests done and no one could really figure it out. I just kind of kept saying, I think I pulled a muscle or slept weird on the plane. And again, just trying to keep it at bay because also I didn't want to get taken off the relay. That was what I worked my whole life for. Also the juxtaposition of when you're getting ready for something like that, you know, I was competing with a bunch of other athletes who were also trying to make the Olympic Games. I went for France, as I mentioned before. I'm a dual citizen. And, you know, I always felt more of a connection with the French side of me with swimming, my mother having been a French national mm-hmm. member as well. And my collegiate team, there was a lot of jealousy and animosity at times. I dealt with a lot of the, well, she's faking an injury, she's doing this. And that played in my head too. Am I being a little dramatic about this? And I'm like thinking to myself, well, of all the competitions that I want to maybe milk an injury for, the Olympic Games is probably not that one. Right. So there was all this in my head about different things that I was juggling. And it just totally different because, you know, and as you said, compared to other competitions or if you're a professional or things like that, there is this essence of there's nothing else like it. And I don't think I quite understood it until I got there. And once I went to the Olympics, I was like, I get it. I get why people say this is what they're training their whole life for. I get it. Like the light bulb went on. I call it the Disney World of sports. Like everything is just perfect. The people are perfect. The location is perfect. The, you know, all of the facilities are perfect. Just everything. I mean, down to like where I could get a Powerade bottle with the scan of this thing I had around my neck outside my building. And it was just like every detail you could want was crossed off. I got an MRI within the village. You know, think about even as an athlete, I still had to go to like a certain facility and see a team doctor and things like that. Like they had those things for us in the village. It was just like when you got there, you understand also the pressure behind it. It is like a pressure cooker in one sense. So it's, I don't even know if I have the right words to describe it. And now looking back, mm-hmm. but I think the one thing that does help manage it is that you're around other people who are doing it as well. And it's almost like you don't know any different. Like I look back, I'm like, how did I ever do that? But when you're in that world and you've never been out of that world, you also don't know a different lifestyle. And the nice thing with the Olympics is that at least like you've got other people who also have the experience. There's no country, I think, in the world that is sending an entirely new federation of people that have not been there. There's going to be someone who has Olympic experience. And I think then that plays in looking to people to get more knowledge about, you know, well, I feel like this, or I feel like that, or how am I going to do this? And people can kind of guide you. I think there is that, like, as much as there is a brotherhood, like maybe with the NFL, there is a brotherhood, I think, amongst Olympians and not just within your own country, but amongst each other as well.
I try to explain it to people. I say, think of the most stressful thing you've done, right? Like maybe a piano solo in high school or going for your driver's license. And then you multiply that by 100. That's the pressure at the Olympics. I mean, I remember just watching the athletes that I worked with at my first Olympics. I could hardly breathe when I was there. And you talk to them. And you know, part of it is, of course, that's what they do for a living. But as Margot said, you don't really realize what it's like until you get there. And it hits pretty strong, you know. So one of the the challenges as a sports psychologist working with an Olympic team is preparing them for that, right? And having some plans in place, how they, because one of the things I think that works the best is just keeping things as normal as possible, right? Keep not changing things up at the last minute. That is usually a recipe for disaster. So how do you do that mentally and emotionally, trying to just keep it normal?
Something interesting about what you both just said, and it's not something that I had kind of addressed when we talked about, you know, where we go today, but I'm thinking of the folks that we serve, and they're also under a pressure cooker to survive. And unless you've been in that life and you've seen it, you don't have that level of understanding. So, and when you change something, you know, our folks live lives in routines because that helps keep them alive, as they see. So changing that routine is very scary. So maybe getting well or the fear of that. So it's just something that came to me that they're, it's completely opposite ends of the spectrum, but the emotional reactions and the emotional responses seem pretty similar because there's pressure in both. They're just different kinds of pressure.
I think anytime you're dealing with anxiety and fear, it's always a challenge for human beings. We, you know, change is very difficult for us. And one of the things I talk about with our graduate students in training is, you know, think about from a point of view of the lifestyle of the person that's been struggling with addiction. It has done certain things for them. It's helped them cope in certain ways, probably. It's been something that's part, they see it as, oh, this worked for me in this area or in that area. So now you're going to take that away. So what are you going to replace that with, right? You got to have some ideas and some coping strategies for that.
And they work very hard. Athletes work very hard to reach a certain level. And when they get there, they work hard to maintain it. So do the folks that we serve. We think that it's not a lot of work involved. It's kind of a lazy lifestyle. It is far from a lazy lifestyle for someone to kind of hustle and survive. Again, not the same, but there are similarities in behaviors and some of the behaviors and emotional responses. So you talked a little bit about what it was like in the Olympic Village. You don't know what it's like till you get there. Hard to explain. Everything you need was right there, which is really kind of, you talked about some of the challenges you had in terms of competing for the jealousies and things, competing for France, being a dual citizen. Were there things you did regularly that were part of your kind of routine to keep yourself emotionally, mentally prepared, you know, to compete? And then Shane, what would you recommend in working with athletes? Kind of how would you help them maintain their routines?
I think for me, it was just kind of trying to keep as much of a sense of normalcy in my life. I don't think I looked, when I look back, I didn't really do anything different. What was different really was just that I was dealing with an injury that was pretty serious now looking back. You know, my day-to-day was just kind of similar. Like you maintain your training regimen, you maintain the coaches that you're used to training with. I had to adapt certain things based on the race that I was going to be competing in, but I just kind of tried to keep it the same, you know, and that sounds maybe like anticlimactic, but as Shane mentioned before, like you're never going to want to do something really drastic that close to the games or close to any competition for that matter. You don't want to totally uproot your training style and change this and change that. You want to try and be as consistent as possible. So I think what helped me was just being consistent. And with that injury was making sure like I wasn't missing practice. I was trying to keep my body as healthy as possible. I was trying to get the best kind of sleep I could. Just really just trying to keep myself in as top shape as I could.
I think one of the things that has evolved over the years that I've noticed is that we at the Olympics, at any rate, I think a lot of professional sports too, we're just more sophisticated about understanding what the challenges are. I think one of the things Margot said is very true. We try to bring in people that have had that experience to help the folks who haven't been there yet anticipate a little bit about what are some of the things that they're going to be coming up against, because particularly on the American team, a lot of athletes and coaches in sports like track and field and swimming and so on, they're expected to win medal. There's a very high, so the media pressure, you know, and now social media nowadays. So how do you fulfill your obligations and do all that, but at the same time, keep things normal and keep a routine? And a routine is really one of the ways that we do that, Jeff, is we really think about like, hey, what are some of the little rituals, some of the touchstones, some of the things that you like to do that you know work for you? Let's make sure you bring that with you and sort of mentally, emotionally, behaviorally, you can do some of those things on a daily basis so that it does start to feel normal for you again, despite all this hoopla. We used to call it five-ring fever. I mean, people really do act a little crazy around the Olympics, to be honest.
And I can understand why. I mean, even for me competing on the track, I had the same routine when I got into starting blocks, and it was just something that worked for me. And I made sure I did it. It became second nature, but it was something that got my head in the right spot too. Okay, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I know everything that follows. And I'll certainly, again, it's not at that level. It was lower collegiate level, but still, it's the same kind of routine.
I think these lessons of mental preparation, they work at every level. It's not something that, of course, the stakes are different at the higher elite levels, but for every athlete, they have to find these lessons and work them out for themselves.
I wasn't sure whether I liked winning or hated losing more. I couldn't tell after a while. So this is something really specifically for Shane, but feel free to jump in on this, Margowitz. How important were the relationships that you developed with the athletes in helping them prepare? And were they used to working with a psychologist by the time they reached the level of international competition?
Well, as I say, that changed a lot. I remember feeling very lonely when I first got to the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs, Colorado, because none of the athletes wanted to work with me. I worked with this one young table tennis player who was brave enough to come into the sports psychologist's office. Remember, this is 1986, right? Yeah. He went away to nationals and he won nationals. I came to the office on the next Monday morning and there was a line of like 10 athletes outside the door. Totally coincidental that I had anything. I didn't have anything to do with him winning nationals. He'd done an immense amount of training and preparation. He was just ready to win, but it's just one of those weird things, you know, and then you start to gradually get accepted. Well, fast forward 40 years later, and yeah, athletes have lots of experience with sports psychology preparation. They've read about it. Their coaches are well-informed. That's something we try to do a lot of nowadays is coach preparation. As Margot said, you know, some of the things that coaches used to do, we don't want them doing that anymore. We want them adapting to the new world. And even at the collegiate level, a lot of athletes now have had experience with sports psychology and mental health counseling through either their athletic department or maybe the counseling center on campus and so on. So yeah, things have changed greatly in terms of, I think, the level of expectation and familiarity with mental health and mental performance for athletes.
And I think here in Connecticut, we hear it about, especially very recently, with Coach Danny Hurley, how he would have a hard time separating coaching life from family life, and he'd be really wired tight when he got home. And his wife said, hey, this is impacting everything. So he did go and see somebody, and they worked out ways where he can kind of have a more balanced kind of life. And I think that presents a good role model for people that watch, for young athletes to see that it's okay to get some assistance with things to help you move ahead.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are some of the techniques or exercises that you would commonly use with athletes to kind of help them mentally prepare? I know that every person's different because they're individuals, but were there commonalities in some of the things that you did?
Well, Margot can probably speak to her experience of implementing that in her own career, but you know, like some of the things that I work a lot with athletes on, I think imagery is very important. Imagining ahead of time what you're going to do, what your plans are, you know, seeing yourself be ready for different stressful situations, pre-event planning. So that's something I work a lot with athletes on. You know, sometimes it comes down to what's the issue for the athlete. I mean, some athletes that I work with are burned out. They're probably overtrained and they need a little either physical and or mental break from the sport and to rediscover their love for it. Because most athletes go into sports because they love it, right? It's because it's just something that they're good at, but they love to do it. And you hate to see athletes lose that. That's actually why I wrote the book, The Cheers and the Tears, which was about sort of a healthy approach to youth sports, because it is something that I see in Connecticut where parents put way too much pressure on kids around youth sports, starting at the little league level, but certainly continuing up to the high school level. And you see it all the time, parents behaving badly, you know. So some of it, I think, starts at the parental and family level and trying to get some education there.
I can attest to that as a football official from youth sports all the way up through Division III in college. I never had problems with coaches at the higher level they got. They understood the guidelines of what they could say and get away with. But the horrible things that I heard from parents at the youth level, not only about us, but about the other kids, was just horrible. It's awful.
There's a lot of truth to that, for sure. For me, what helped was a lot of that visualization, I think, is just kind of innate anyways when you think about swimming, because you're staring at a black line for two and a half hours. So, you know, you got to keep your thoughts occupied. There were definitely times where just by trying to think of things to think about while I'm swimming and while I'm training is seeing myself at a certain competition or trying to tell myself what something was going to feel like, getting used to a certain time, getting used to a certain interval, the repetition of it, and also just the forecasting of what it would be. I remember there were some friends of mine that I wanted to see again at the Olympics. They were from other countries, and the only way I was going to see them again, obviously, would have been if I was at the Olympics. And I remember swimming and being in my head, be like, well, if you ever want to get back there and if you ever want to see those people again, you better move your, you know what, yeah, a little faster right now. You're going through that in your head. So the visualization, sometimes it can seem a little woo, but it really is true. You got to be able to see yourself doing it before it becomes a reality. And I think that's, you see that with anything in life, you know, the manifestation and that whole thing, that's really kind of, if you go on social media, it's all over the place, but it really is true because your body will then adjust to something that your mind has already seen and created.
If we go back to our clients that we work with, you know, on a day-to-day basis, you have to be able to see yourself, right, in recovery and without the substance. And if you can't even get to that step, then there's still work to be done.
It's what do you see? Where do you see yourself, or what do you see for yourself? As opposed to what our field used to be, was this is what I see and this is what everybody should want. To me, the idea of using visualizations and imagery, especially in swimming, is fascinating because I'm used to competing in visual sports. Even on the track, I can see the finish line, I can see things, and you're not relying on visuals in the pool. And I find that absolutely fascinating because it's so challenging. So I'm glad you shared about the imagery because it helps clarify it.
That's why so much of it is back to that sensation thing. Like when I was on point, I knew what my splits felt like. Like I knew if I was on or if I was off. You do get a glimpse of people when you take a flip turn. You can see a little bit when you're taking your breath. But I remember, I always say, like the pool at the Olympics, I felt like I was swimming in open water. Most of the international pools will be 10 lanes instead of 8, and they'll keep an open lane on both ends. Mm-hmm. And it just, I remember feeling like it was the widest, largest pool. I didn't know if I was first, if I was last. I feel like I blacked out on that day. But most other races, it all went back to, it's like muscle memory almost. You might catch your coach out of your eye, at the corner of your eye, you know, doing a little like, yeah, you're on, or, you know, pick it up, and you can kind of gauge, all right, I'm on or I'm off. But most times you can kind of feel that.
Yeah,
the Michael concentration. And
I, we were jumping in on the same direction there because yeah, imagery is not just visualization. It's all six senses, the five senses that you're usually familiar with, but then kinesthetic sense is really important in sport. And most athletes, to be honest, like the kinesthetic sense is the better form of imagery for them rather than the visual. Actually, started to understand this from a scientific perspective when you do brain scans of athletes when they're imagining performing a motor action, like shooting a free throw and so on, the same areas of the brain light up as when they're actually performing that. So we call it functional equivalence theory. Part of what imagery can do is rehearse for you in your brain without actually needing to be on the court. So it's really fascinating that way.
What would you take from your experiences at the Olympics? What was something that you took home with you? I mean, I'm sure in your memory, and there are many things, but is there anything that stands out?
I think for me, so in 2012, France was the third fastest country that year. It was an electric year. I mean, we might be a tiny little country, but we had a lot of golds, a lot of medals in general. And I think it was like just this feeling, like I said earlier, of I get it. It makes sense. I felt almost like a feeling of like it was worth it, like it paid off, a feeling of vindication in a way, like I didn't do it all for nothing. And it would have been a fine, a great career, and I would have been happy, I think, regardless. But looking back on the things I put my body through, the things I put my mind through, all of that to come out with that at the end just almost made it feel like now, at least, and maybe for me being older, just being like, okay, it really was worth it. And I can say like, I got everything I wanted to out of it. But yeah, I think it was that overall feeling of I get it, because you don't get it until you're there. I mean, yeah, everybody gets excited to watch it and stuff, but to be there and to feel like, wow, I'm here. I'm one of them. I'm one of these people. I'm an Olympian. It just was a really rewarding feeling in a way that I can't accurately put into words, but it was just like a sigh of relief. Like you're like, I got it. I get to do this. I get to be here. I earned this. I worked for it, and it paid off, because as I mentioned earlier, like my mom was 1/100 of a second off. There's so many athletes who come that fraction close. One of my best friends, we were thinking we were going to make it together. We had made our first national team together for the European Championships. He missed it by 3/100 of a second. And he got second place, which usually second place automatically goes, yep. But it was 3/100 off the time standard and France didn't budge and didn't take him. So it was a sense of relief, I guess, in a best way to sum it up. It was relief, was a feeling of peace in a way.
Now, you mentioned to me in an earlier conversation, being a world-class athlete, it creates a lifestyle different from what you may have been accustomed to. Working to that level creates a very specific kind of lifestyle that you kind of follow to be successful. But you did say it's not unlike what the folks that we serve go through to create a new lifestyle for recovery. They have a way that worked for them, whether we found it healthy or unhealthy, but they had to create something completely new that many wouldn't understand. And I thought that was fascinating. You know, the circumstances may be radically different, but the change in mindset is very similar. So what lessons can our listeners take from this? And this goes for both.
Shane, I'll let you take this one.
Well, it's interesting. You know, one of the things you were asking about earlier, Jeff, was like, what memories do you have of the Olympics? And one thing that I often tell like the younger sports psychologists, the psychologists who are earlier in their careers, is how stressful it is to be a support personnel at the Olympics. My first Olympics, when I left to go start preparations with the team, my son was 6 months old, my first child. And I came back 7 weeks later, you know, and I was worried, like, will he even recognize me? I always emphasize to trainees nowadays and early career psychologists, have a good support system in place. You really need it because it's tough. There's a lot of travel involved, a lot of loneliness. Thinking about like transitioning over with our clients, same thing for us professionals working in the field. It can be such a tough field, I tell our students all the time, right? There's not always a lot of like pats on the backs and you did a great job and look at all these fantastic things that are happening. You see people struggling. You see some of the same folks coming through back again and trying to pick themselves up off the floor. So we, I think, as professionals have to have a good support system in place so we can stay motivated and encouraged and supportive for the people that we're working with. I think that's really important.
And Margo, you mentioned earlier about that it's a perfect environment, right? You go in and everything is there and this is perfect and that's perfect. It takes work from everybody for things to be that perfect. And I think that's part of the message too, is that we all that work in roles in supporting individuals who wish to find their own recovery, that we work hard to be able to do whatever our role is. So we make the setting, we help create the setting for change.
Yeah, I think it's definitely not like I didn't get to the Olympics on my own. You know, I had my parents, my teammates, my coaches, support system, therapists, physical therapists. It's a wide team when you look at it. I think that the same goes for folks in recovery. It's a wide team. You know, we always say this, the saying of you're not alone, but it really is true, is you're not alone. It takes a village in anything that you want to be successful in. And I think another piece of advice that I would give is that, you know, it goes back to that. It's a piece of your life. It doesn't have to define your whole life. Recovery is difficult. I sit down with patients all the time. I sat down with one today to hear his recovery story, and I put together pieces on people's recovery stories. Everybody's story is different, but it's all the same in the sense that there were challenges along the way. And the thing that always strikes me the most is that, you know, they did get to, quote unquote, the other side. They were able to kind of get that monkey off their back, and it was all because of something or someone else, but it was just a chapter in their life. You know, they all say my life then versus my life now, and it doesn't encapsulate your whole life. And that might've just been a chapter for you. So just like athletics was just a chapter for me, the Olympics, even within my athletic career, was also just a chapter for me.
Just one final question for me. And that is, when we talk about optimal performance for athletes, do you see that being somewhat synonymous with the idea of optimal health for those that we work with, or optimal health as they define it for themselves? There's similarity in the terms.
I think, you know, when you ask me that question, Jeff, I think one thing I think about is what we talked about right at the beginning, which is like, you just can't put it into different compartments and break it up. You really have to have a look at the big picture. One thing I think that's really important when I work with our trainees as substance use counselors is to try and help see their clients in the same way, you know, look at the totality of the picture that they're in and try and help them with other aspects of their lives too, besides just what the addiction is right now, which is, as Margot said, like the monkey on their back, you know, that they're trying to get rid of, but also then to think about their own self-care, and so that they can be there and be emotionally available and supportive for their clients when they need to be.
I think at the end of the day, optimal health, when you look at an athlete, like peak performance, it's always going to be slightly different, because the average person is just not going to have to do what a elite athlete is going to have to do. You know, I remember when I had my labrum fixed, it was 6 weeks from when I got in the door at HSS in New York Hospital for Special Surgery to when I was diagnosed and had my surgery. I was in the waiting room. There were people there that had waited 8 months to get an opinion just from that doctor. And I got in because I had gone to the Olympic Games and because I was still competing. And there was this idea that I was going to keep competing. I think you're always going to see that, where things are expedited because there is a timetable. There's that end game. There's that competition that's XYZ that they need to meet. So I think in that sense, it'll be different. But where I hope that it's the same is that we look at athletes more as a person as well, instead of just like this god, this person who's put on a pedestal. Because at the end of the day, I mean, they are, I knew I was one practice away sometimes from that torn labrum, from a tendonitis, from having to get a cortisone injection. It was, my body was in such great shape, but at the same time, it was just like a little needle in a haystack away from some type of injury, because it was on that threshold of almost being overworked most times. And the same goes for your mental state. You know, it could be just one bad practice, one more bad race or bad meet that just sets you over the edge and you go into a spiral. And next thing you know, you're in a depressive episode. And it's that, it's really kind of finite. So I wish that, while I don't think it's ever going to be the same in how you look at the general public and elite athlete, I do wish that the world would look a little bit more under the lens of, it's still a human. It's still a person. It's just like how we look at celebrities. What's that saying in the tabloids? Like, stars, they're just like us. Like, you know, athletes, they're still just like us. They just have to do different things. Yeah, I think it has the basis of needing to be there. I just don't know that it always will be there, given on what their ultimate end goal is.
Anything else to add for either of you before we finish up?
I think this is great. I think it's a conversation that needs to be had. And, you know, we keep relating it back to the world of mental health and the world of addiction and substance use. And I think that there's a lot to be uncovered in the world of athletics too. I think there's a lot of stigma or discrimination against how we view athletes. And so conversations like this are important. I think I'm not going to compare it and say that it's the same, because it's not, but in the sense of, we don't talk about it as much, we glorify it. And I think conversations like this just kind of take a little bit of the shine off to see that it's still real people. And at the beginning of this conversation, when we spoke about the way people at home, the fans, the spectators, they all react, I think if more people can listen to conversations like this and hear this kind of insight, that maybe we move in that healthier direction and we take a little bit of that pressure off of these athletes and these coaches and the support staff, because we realize that they are just humans as well, who may have a God-given talent, a talent that they've, you know, worked their butt off for years and years, but they're still humans at their core. Mm-hmm. And we need to give them the same respect and dignity that we would give others who may be struggling or going through their own type of battles as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The human mind is just such a fascinating thing. You could say, well, on the sports side, it's such a positive thing. On the addiction side, it's such a negative thing. But understanding the struggles that people go through and how mentally they approach that, you start to see some commonalities. And I just think that's sort of endlessly fascinating.
Kind of uniting the humanity of all of this, of all individuals. I think that's a great way to finish up. I want to thank both of you for taking the time to join us today and to record this podcast. And I hope our folks out there enjoyed it. That's going to do it for this episode of Scope of Practice. I want to thank again our guests for joining us and for the difference they're helping to make in the lives of people with SUDs. Thank you especially to our listeners, those of you who make all this possible and worthwhile. Your work changes people. We'll see you next time.